Okay, so this is a follow-up interview with Bill Taves of Kane, Manitoba, a producer that I first interviewed back in 2010. And at that time, we had talked about doing a follow-up interview because of the fact that he's with the Canadian Wheat Board, one of the directors there, and that there were big changes in the wind. And those changes have since taken place, so we can follow up on that. The interview is taking place at the Hotel Fort Garry in Winnipeg on November 23rd, 2015. So, Bill, I sent you a copy of your interview, and you had a chance to listen to it, and I did the same thing, and I took a few notes as I was going through, and there are a couple of things that were sort of loose ends at the time, and I want to follow up on those ones before we sort of go more broadly at some of the issues. And one of the things we talked about was the issue with genetically modified flax. Mm-hmm. And at the time there was some problem about shipments not being well received by European customers because there was a very, very tiny amount of genetically modified flax, and that there had been a move to bring legislation in. Can you follow up on that at all? Did you know what happened?
I think I can recollect the essence of that whole scene. The NDP ag critic was trying to bring in legislation that would require a company that wanted to introduce a genetically modified plant in agriculture to some analysis and assessment before it was allowed to become commercialized. And so there was quite a discussion in the parliament, and I actually, as the Wheat Board, it was one of the staff members, and I had gone to Ottawa to speak to our position on it, and but I think we only were able to leave a copy of our submission there. We didn't get to speak to the parliamentary committee or anything. And what happened was it was brought up in the House and tabled, and there was mostly conservatives in there that were opposed to it. And there wasn't a lot of support from some of the ag people. There's always this concern by some of the key ag people, the farmer representatives, that they don't want to be seen to be Luddites and require this additional step of performance appraisal before something is brought in. So there wasn't a hue and cry by the ag community to support this, so it was defeated in the House. And I recall watching the debate on CPAC and hearing my name mentioned in the House of Commons. I just about fell over, thinking, what the hell's going on here, you know? But it was one of the people that was speaking for that regulation, I guess, had seen the paper and had made some reference to it, but it was ultimately defeated. And the flax story has essentially disappeared. We lost a lot of that market in Europe, but have gained markets elsewhere over time. But it was a very costly experience for farmers in Western Canada. A lot of problems. We were required to send in samples of any flax that we wanted to sell and have it checked for this particular modification.
Mm-hmm. So, when just the practicalities of it. So, I'm assuming that this flax was in a shipment, actually headed over to Europe, was offloaded and then tested?
I don't think it was offloaded, although I could be wrong, but it would never... It never saw commercial use in Europe. It was shipped back. I don't think it was offloaded on the ship. I think they checked it before it was offloaded. Mm. and there was a ship of floating around in the ocean looking for a market for this flax.
Okay. Now, so the flax then that would have been sitting back at your farm, what happens to it in that case?
Well, what really happened in the flax industry is that they tried to run it through the U.S. Crushing mills because they weren't particularly concerned about it. And eventually, I think after 2 or 3 years, they moved enough out so that I think they felt that they didn't have that problem anymore. Mm. So I haven't heard anything about that for quite a while.
So did that stop the production of, because I think it was a relatively small...
It's a relatively small crop too in terms of acreage, but it's pretty well lost its place in southern Manitoba. I think there's still a fair amount grown in Saskatchewan and in the States, but it did have an impact on the growers' views about it because, I mean, it always created, it was a bit of a problematic crop anyway for weed control and whatever, but I think this was sort of the last straw for farmers. They just felt it was too much of a problem.
Yeah.
And so there's very little flax growing in my area now. I don't know whether or not there's a marketing mm-hmm. issue anymore or not.
Yeah. So that ties up that little loose end. Then we had moved on to a discussion about the whole area of farmers' involvement in grain research.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, you had mentioned that you had been a representative for Keystone Agricultural Producers on the Western Grain Research Foundation. Have I got all those names right? So at that time, so this was 2010, there were moves afoot to reorganize the research on the prairies, going to a clustered approach. And you had mentioned that the Canadian Wheat Board had been quite active in supporting grain research on behalf of the farmers. So from over the 5 years that we've been through, have there been any changes there?
Well, I guess the most obvious thing is a change in the organization of how research funding is collected and forwarded to the research community. I think it was a mistake, and I think it will be a mistake in the future, is with the loss of the board, the collection system, of course, is quite different because the board used to just take a cut of all of the returns from selling wheat and transfer a small portion into the research community on an annual basis through the Western Grains Research Foundation. Now they've set up individual provincial committees to collect it and prioritize the research. And I think they may do some useful things, but I always felt that on a prairie-wide basis, there was no point in having the provinces partitioned or the prairies partitioned into the three different communities, because I think the research community won't find that particularly useful, and I think the committees may be at cross purposes when they're allotting money to the various researchers. There won't be that uniformity and sort of a collective approach in the research community and the funding agency to do things more efficiently and together. Mm-hmm. I don't think there's that much difference between the three provinces in terms of wheat research in particular. And I thought the Western Grains Research Foundation was working very well. It's still functioning. In the meantime, these three provincial organizations are up and running. And I think the intention was by Mr. Ritz is to shut down the Western Grains Research Foundation and just have the provincial committees look after this. And I'm hoping that that changes with the new government, that they will take a different approach. I don't know how, once they've got these provincial committees established, it would be hard to shut them down, but there might be a way of having them do close collaboration with the Western Greens Research Foundation in terms of prioritizing the research and so forth. But it just creates another level of administration and bureaucracy and uncertainty, really.
Now, I think you started out your comments by saying that you didn't think that the researchers would find it that useful either.
Well, I think in the area of what they were doing in the research community, it was putting the research community through a process of changing the whole structure of research and clustering. To be honest with you, I don't know how that's all gone. I know that they were very unhappy with it, or with not just with that, but with the constant change in direction and organization that the bureaucrats and the politicians gave them. They were having trouble setting long-term goals and meeting them without being interrupted by the changes in administration. So I'm not sure how that went, and I just figure now the research community will have to apply to three or four different groups to get the funding for their research, and it'll probably make things a little rockier.
You may not be able to answer this question, but out of those three prairie provinces, Alberta, Saskatchewan, and Manitoba, there are different fund availabilities. Mm-hmm. So was there an impact on Manitoba in particular? Because, you know, was the research money even there, or even the size of the farming communities? Is there... did that have any impact, at the university and research level that you were familiar with?
No, I honestly don't know what the university community has done in the last while. The Manitoba committee has just been set up within the last 8 months or so, 10 months. Mm-hmm. So they've just barely gotten going. The cost to the farmers is higher than it was before, because there's two agencies now that are doing the checkout, so theoretically there should be more money in total for the research. But part of the checkoff money now is going to the Canadian International Grains Institute, because at one time it was a board that supported the Grains Institute, and now it's through a checkoff. So Manitoba will proportionally be putting in about as much money as they did before into that organization.
Have the private companies, do you know whether they've sort of upped their contributions now that...
Yeah, I think there's been some input by the private grain companies into SIGI. I don't know whether they're doing any more in research. I think a number of them have their own breeding programs. In fact, we're in competition with the public sector and with the funding that was provided by farmers for the public sector. I think, generally speaking, I think farmers appreciated the public sector's involvement in breeding, because it kept the costs of purchasing seed grain down by quite a significant margin. I think the fear that farmers have is that if it's all privatized, they'll be paying the same cost for, say, wheat that they do for canola or soybean, which has really gone out of sight, really.
Speaking of wheat versus canola then, just quickly, mm-hmm. Even though canola seed input is higher, there has been is it fair to say there's been a steady growth in the percentage of crop that farmers are putting in that mm-hmm. are canola?
Yeah, I think the acreage increased quite a bit, and the volume of canola, of course, has gone up. It was particularly high in 2013-14, just like it was for wheat. But I think there are a few farmers now that are, at least in Manitoba, that are starting to look at soybeans as a replacement to canola, just because of a risk factor and the cost. Soybean seed is quite expensive. I think it costs about $75 an acre to plant an acre of soybeans, but you only have that cost. You're not paying for nitrogen fertilizer, so it makes quite a difference, and the fungicides aren't really that critical for it either, and it spreads out the harvest load too throughout the fall. So some of the glow of canola has gone down a bit because it's just a little riskier, and the costs are not just in the seed, they're in the fertilizer and the fungicides.
So could you say what the per acreage cost is for canola and say wheat?
Well, I would,
factoring in those extra inputs.
Well, I'm guessing, let's see, just on the basics, for canola, you'd be looking at $80 at least for nitrogen fertilizer. We won't worry about the phosphate. Although that's pretty important too. And the weed control is another $25 an acre. Fungicides would be another $25 an acre. So before you get going, you spent at least a couple hundred dollars an acre, and you haven't even pulled your machine out of the shed yet. And soybeans, it's sort of just the one expense for seed right off the bat.
When you say risk, you said canola is, or you're mentioning risk. Is that an actual growing risk, or yeah, is that just?
Well, it would be more subject to hail damage than soybeans would be. Although soybeans can be damaged as well. But generally speaking, insect populations are always more of a problem. So you're going to be applying insecticides more likely on canola than you would on soybean.
Why the, other than the actual cost of it, why weren't farmers growing soybeans more? Was there no market?
Well, I think the soybean varieties were a little too long for Manitoba, so they were bringing in some Ontario varieties and some U.S. varieties, and only recently has there been a fair amount of breeding done on soybeans from Manitoba, shorter season varieties, and it's sort of taken off from there, because I can't recall farmers getting stung with frost that killed the soybeans.
They're pretty hardy.
They're pretty hardy in fall. They're not very hardy in spring.
Okay.
But they're pretty hardy in fall. And they're just easier to grow.
And harvest?
And harvest, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Moving on to sort of wrapping up some of the details of the previous interview, you had talked about producer car loading sites.
Mm-hmm.
And this was the whole producer car issue was one that was front and center when it came with to the dismantling of the wheat board, because the wheat board was a real advocate for producer cars.
Yeah.
Correct. So I don't know if these are two related issues, but I have them one after the other. No, let's just do producer cars.
Mm-hmm.
Any changes over the last 5 years?
Well, I haven't followed very closely in the last 3 years. As you're aware, I've retired from farming, and I haven't been paying as close attention to that, because I never was involved in producer cars really myself, and I would rely on the media and some farmers that I knew in Saskatchewan in particular that would talk about it. I honestly don't know whether there's more producer cars or less under the current system. I've always felt that at some point the grain companies that have primary elevators will do their best to hamper producer cars because that they take away from their handling fees that farmers would use if they're using their primary elevators. So I think we'll need to keep the independent terminals around in the systems because they will, they're not relying on primary elevators to make their profit.
That leads to two other items. One was at the time, one of the things that you had mentioned with the inland terminals, and if there were was a producer car site, there were incentives for hauling mm-hmm. to the inland elevators in order to draw business away mm-hmm. from the producer car deliveries. Any changes there that you know of? The incentives for hauling?
I honestly don't have a good handle on that right now. I'd have to talk to some of my friends to see what's happened yeah. to them. I know the producer car business was pretty intense when the 13-14 crop was trying to be marketed because the grain companies had such a high basis that it really paid for farmers to use producer cars.
Now, what did you mean by a really high basis?
Well, the difference between the port price and the street price or the elevator price, it would include all of the things that you have in handling and transportation, plus return to investment. And over the last 3 years, there's been a very high basis, which means that farmers are getting less of the port price for their grain. And that's been documented by Dr. Richard Gray in a number of papers that he's been monitoring the situation and finding that overall farmers are sort of doing about $2 or $3 billion a year. It's a lot of money.
That is not something that would be a surprise to the people who were supporters of the wheat board. But do the farmers, does it really have an impact on the farmers, or are they doing so well that they really don't notice?
Well, you know, that's a good question because I really don't know. I don't think farmers are aware, for example, of this study, even though it's been public. And I guess they're always a little suspicious of papers of that nature where ag economists have gone in and examined this. I think farmers have just been anxious to move the grain recently, and they haven't been as concerned about whether they're getting the top dollar for it or not. And I think it's a bit of a scandal. I mean, I don't blame the grain companies for exercising their ability to control what comes into the elevator by increasing the basis, because the system couldn't handle the amount of grain that they were being offered. So I mean, it's just business, really. But that was the difference between the way the board handled basis and the way the grain companies handled basis. Just as a general rule, wheat board basis was based on actual costs of shipment, and there were no, the restrictions that were placed on farmers' delivery were on a contract basis. They could deliver a certain portion of a contract at a given period of time, and so they didn't have to restrict the flow of grain into the elevator by increasing the basis. It was done by contract, and that's really hurting now when we have an excess amount of grain in the system and the basis levels are staying pretty high because grain companies can't handle all the grain that would be offered to them if they offered the price that was relative to the port price.
So what's the storage situation on the farm then? Is it...
Well, there's been a lot of bins, new grain bins put up. That's partly due to the fact that the elevator terminals are at quite some distance now, and farmers need that space when they're harvesting. But secondly, it's probably staying in the bins longer. And I'm not one of the normal people in the system, but I've got 40,000 bushels a week that I haven't sold from last year, and some of it from the year before, because I've been angry and I'm not gonna sell this stuff for under a certain price. But I mean I can afford to do it simply because I'm selling out, and my accountant doesn't want me to be selling and paying a lot of tax on stuff if I can postpone it for a little while.
Is there a shelf life on stored grain?
Well, if it's in good condition, wheat, for example, can be stored for years.
Okay.
Canola, I'd be a little hesitant to do that, although if it was dry enough, say down to 7% moisture, you can store that for quite a long time too. When it gets borderline into the damp range, that's when you have to be worried about, particularly canola. Mm. You always want to be checking your canola and move it, if you can, as quickly as possible.
So what's sitting in your bins? A little bit of everything?
No canola.
No canola. Now, at the time you were had just started to use Delmar Commodities as mm-hmm. your... Are they still around?
Yeah, they're still around, and they're still buying and selling grain. I haven't really done much business there recently, except with the soybean business, because they have a soybean crushing plant right at their location, and you haul directly into the plant, and generally speaking, they are priced a little better than the mainland companies, because it goes right into their mill, as opposed to being handled by the mm-hmm. by the grain elevator. So, but I think I was a little concerned about my method of selling grain when I was deferring quite a bit of the income to the next year. I got caught in that cycle, and I was a little concerned that Delmar Commodities, being a small company, there might be more risk there in doing that. So I've just generally worked on a cash basis with them. They may be perfectly fine, but there's been cases before where companies have suddenly gone belly up, and your farmers that haven't been paid out get caught with hundreds of thousands of dollars.
So who would you deliver to now then?
Well, I generally haul to Morris, where there's a Patterson and a Cargill. And you know, you just go wherever you can make it a deal, because they're not always able to take the grain you want to haul. So sometimes it's just because one company is taking wheat and another one isn't, you might go there. It's not as if you can haul any grain at any time. And I guess some companies, for example, Patterson has a different standard for mildew grain, because their sales are mostly going to the U.S. The U.S. isn't as fussy. Cargill, on the other hand, is going to Thunder Bay, or maybe even West Coast, where they're going by the tougher Canadian standards. And so there might be a difference of a grade there. So you take that into account when you deliver or choose an elevator company. Mm-hmm. But I have to be honest with you, I haven't been as active in searching out the markets or the grain elevators like I might have been at one time.
Mm-hmm. From what you hear from other farmers who are still active, is there good competition between, or is it mainly just a question of who's taking what when? And the prices are pretty standard.
Well, there is certainly some competition. I just had a text message today that where Morris Cargill was offering wheat at a certain price, and you sort of decide whether you're going to accept that or not. And if you're interested in moving grain, you might check with a couple of other grain companies, and they may not be taking wheat, or they may not be offering the same price. So I think there's a bit of competition, but right now the grain companies can get as much grain in as they want. It's not as if they're clamoring for your grain.
Mm-hmm.
I always liked it when the grain company started phoning around for oats when I was growing quite a bit of oats. And you knew once they started phoning, the chances are the price was going to keep going up for a while. You could sort of had to outguess them as to when that would plateau.
Any impact that you know of on malt barley?
No, I really don't know the malt barley situation at all, because there's very little of it grown in my area, so I haven't been following that very closely at all.
Okay, moving right along, a little later on in the previous interview, we talked about the impact of the demise of the Canadian Wheat Board. Maybe before I go into that, is there anything that you want to say or can say about, because we talked nothing about the other than being on the board was challenging. Is there anything that you wanted to say about that whole thing, how that whole thing went down, for the record, or?
Well, I think I can say it was particularly difficult to have an agency like the Canadian Wheat Board legislated by the federal government to perform in a certain way as a single desk, and then to have appointees by the government to the board which were determined to take it under. And I thought, you know, really this would be a challenge, really, from a governance point of view, to allow that to happen. So that was always a problem for me. And you know, if farmers had a different opinion, that was fine, because they were elected, and that would have you know, some political importance to know what farmers are thinking by electing certain kinds of farmers for the farmer directed board. But I always resented the fact that you would have appointed directors who were not favorable to the single desk, because that was the mandate of the board by legislation.
Has the how it was a really intense time during that 2011 through to 2012, and even within the farming community, there was you know, a lot of intense debate. Mm-hmm. Has that just sort of settled down? What are farmers thinking now?
Well,
from your perspective.
I'm not sure if they're thinking a lot about it. There's still a very active group based out of Saskatchewan called the Canadian Wheat Board Alliance that still has and the Friends of the Canadian Wheat Board that have an ongoing court case. But I think you don't get into a lot of intense discussions where I am. I suspect that if you go to a meeting in Saskatchewan, or maybe somewhere in northern Manitoba, in Dauphin or whatever, you might get a lot more discussion about it. But
why would the discussion be, why would there be more of a discussion in those two regions?
Well, I think in my area, we have access to a number of grain companies, so you can assume that there's more competition there. In some areas, there's very little competition, and I think they'd be more inclined to be annoyed about that or concerned about it, and how it might affect their ability to extract a proper price out of the grain. But I honestly don't think it's going to be a situation where you're going to have a whole, you know, 65% of the farmers going out on the street and protesting. And we had because the government didn't have a plebiscite on the issue, we had one ourselves at the board, and we still, even after all of the hassle that the Minister of Agriculture was giving us, and talking about it to the in the public vein about how poorly we were doing, we still had the support of, I think, 62% of wheat farmers in the prairies, and that was discounted, and I felt very badly about that. I thought farmers, in fact, when I had met with my local MP, we had a discussion about that when I was a director, and we just came to the conclusion that she was, and the government was, believed that they were the ones that would make the decision about the wheat board, and I felt farmers should make it. And I just thought that was the reasonableness of it, but as it turned out, that wasn't the case.
Did you follow at all what happened after the directors were sort of sent on their way? Because it went through a few different...
Yeah, we had a couple of... We challenged that ruling in, or that legislation in court, and I remember we...
The legislation being the new, removal of the...
Yeah, new, the new Wheat Board Act.
Okay.
And we won the first case. It was interesting. It was a bit of a surprise, but we won the case. The judge had a decision within a day, but then the federal government appealed, and we lost the appeal. And I think we tried to take it to the, or have it looked at by the Supreme Court, and they didn't hear it. So that was sort of it. But there still is a case for what do you call it?
The assets?
The assets, yeah. That need to be determined, and whether or not anything will come of that, we don't know yet either. Mm. I think what will happen now is, I think Ralph Goodale has said that the new federal government will look at this, the books, because once it became, once the elected directors were gone, we had no public financial report that would tell us what was really happening. And so this might be an opportunity to see what really happened to the assets.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any thoughts? I mean, you're not actively farming now, except for the bins that are still holding some product. But we had the sort of non-single desk Canadian Wheat Board, and now we have a totally different ownership of the whatever was left of the Wheat Board, including some attempt to involve farmer equity. Do you have anything? I don't know much about, so I can't ask any specific questions, but do you have anything to say about that?
Well, I think the farmer equity portion of the deal is an incentive for farmers to use the new company, the G3, with the idea that you're actually investing in a company. I think it's a bit of a scam, because there's no guarantee that you're going to get the value out of it. Farmer might as well have been better to take that $5 a ton incentive that was going into the fund and just take it right off the top and investing it in your own fund somewhere else, because it didn't allow you to have any control of the organization at all. You're just simply a bystander, mm-hmm. Watching your investment. And I have to wonder, I actually hauled to the voluntary CWB a couple of years ago, and I got my, I think I hauled 500 tons, so I got my $2,500 worth of equity, but I have nothing that shows me I've got that equity, and I'm not too sure whether I ever will. And I guess the company can buy out that equity on their own account if they decide to do that in about, what was it, 6 years or 7 years?
Mm-hmm. I'll now go to the specific predictions that one of the things that some said were an advantage of the demise of the single desk wheat board was the ability to market into the U.S. Oh. What's happened there?
You know, I don't really know very well what's happened. I know that there has been some grain moving into the U.S. There's some brokers that are doing a bit of business in that regard. And there has been some shipments for really high quality wheat to certain mills. But it hasn't been a big explosion of shipment down in the U.S. I don't know all the ins and outs of that whole scene. It just isn't what I thought it might be. There haven't been a lot of farmers in the U.S. being ticked off because they don't see a whole bunch of trucks parked at elevators that they're trying to deliver to. So I'm not really sure what the answer to that question is.
Mm-hmm. Associated with that was the issue of becoming a North American market, mm-hmm. and Canada not concentrating on the reputation that it had built over years for a higher quality product and going for the higher yielding
higher quality and consistency.
Consistency. So yeah. Anything developing there?
The first reports after the new board had been in place, after the private trade had taken over the sales, there were quite a few complaints coming in from some of our customers. I know that in Japan and I believe Indonesia. That our reputation for being able to deliver on time and so forth was followed up, but part of that might have been due to the large crop and difficulty the railways had. They complained about the winter being extremely tough, but we lost a lot of money with ships waiting at the port there for extended periods of time, and I think initially there was a fair amount of disorganization there, with everybody falling over themselves trying to get their ships loaded and get their grain to port and so forth. But I'm sure that we will have a North American system sometime in the not too distant future. I know that the one complaint the American U.S. Wheat Associates have, not the Wheat Associates, the I believe it's the North Dakota Wheat Commission, feels that they don't have access to our elevators like they should have, because we still have a restriction on dumping American varieties of wheat into the Canadian system. That's their next attack, and I think it's going to be an irresistible attack in the Canadian system. And I think for the grain companies, it doesn't make a lot of difference. There's really not a particular body other than perhaps SIGI and the Grain Commission that will protect our ability to segregate and deliver the kind of grain that we want to deliver. I think it'll eventually collapse, because when the Wheat Board was in charge of that, they were aware of the value of it. The grain companies are more concerned about the margin between what they have to sell for and what they pay for it. So their mandate isn't to keep the price to farmers up at a level that we might have had under the board. So I still think that'll probably go the way of the dodo bird too.
Mm.
Dodo bird.
Now, one of the things that has also changed is the amount of international grain company ownership. Does that have any impact at all on the farmers?
I really don't know. It's kind of disturbing that too, the whole pool elevator system is now owned by a company in Switzerland. And the wheat board is owned by Bunge and a Saudi Arabian government monopoly. And it just seems that, you know, that their main concern isn't the welfare of the farmers. I mean, it's just logical. They're interested in running their business. And it's kind of volatile because now the company that bought Viterra is considering selling off their ag assets. And you can only imagine that in that process, there's, with all of the changes in ownership and so forth, that it's caused, there must be quite a bit of additional cost attached to that whole process. But I can't specify quantitatively that there's a certain amount of money that is involved in that.
That was the end of our list of predictions. Although, and I don't have exactly what this point was related to, but you had made some comment about the international companies such as Viterra and Cargill would fare fine, I think your comment might have been, but then you did mention Patterson, Richardson, and P&H, which were Canadian companies, and how they might do because of the changes.
Yeah. I think Patterson is big enough that they'll probably do fine, although there may, it, perhaps the family will decide that if a right offer comes along, they might sell. Patterson Heinbecker, I think, is probably more likely to phase out and sell out their operation when they see a good opportunity.
Richardson's
has been expanding. They've become an international company now, and I suspect they run pretty well, so they'll probably be doing okay. They've taken over a number of other grain elevator sites from Viterra in the process of the mergers that had been going on, and they seem to be doing quite well.
One of the things that I talked to other people about as a result of the change, and this is just an observation, a non-scientific observation on my part, that the availability of information to farmers on markets and prices and so on, has that changed at all? The wheat board used to provide the market analysis and all of those things. Have SIGI and private companies sort of taken over that role to provide farmers with information that they used to get through the wheat board?
Yeah, I think the private companies are doing as good a job, or at least some of them are doing as good a job as you might expect them to do in helping farmers to make decisions about when is a good time to price their grain, but that's really all it's based on. Other companies that I've dealt with really don't have any sense of what to tell a farmer at all. And then, of course, there's a number of private companies that do nothing but analyze and sell their services to farmers at a cost. And they seem to be doing pretty well. I think they might charge about $10 an acre or so to tell you when to sell your grain and so forth. It's like you do anything else. It's like custom combining or custom spraying. You hire the help you need to make it work. At some point, you might question whether you could do it better yourself. Mm-hmm. But I honestly don't know. I think the wheat board used to be very good at putting out information, discussing the nature of various customers, where the strength was, what some of the problems were, and being able to organize the grain shipments to meet the customer demand. And I think that's a bit of a haphazard now.
The I guess the last question I'll ask has to do with the shipments. You mentioned the ocean or seaways shipments and the demurrage costs going up because of at least initially some the large crops and also maybe an initial confusion. What about the railway situation? Did anything change there with the demise of the wheat board?
Well, the one thing that changed was farmers did not have a tool or an agency to hold the railroads to account. Now we depend on the grain companies and the government to step in. The government did step in for in the 13-14 crop. But the board used to monitor and have a good handle on what was happening in the system and was able to provide that information to farmers. And I miss that kind of hands-on approach to understanding what was going on in the system. Now, we would always calculate the demurrage that was occurring and the board was paying for, the dispatch that we were earning. The board was very good at organizing the shipments to the ports and minimizing the amount of demurrage that was going to happen and trying to maximize the amount of dispatch. I mean, there's times when there was demurrage which we couldn't do anything about, but generally speaking, that was a fairly major consideration. And that, I think, having that single desk was very efficient, relatively speaking, compared to what we have now.
Mm-hmm. And along with that, the Canada Ports Clearance Association was dismantled and likely wasn't necessary, under the new system.
I honestly don't have much to say about that. I'm not familiar with that at all.
Yeah. So that's the end of my questions for follow-up. Is there anything I should have asked you or that you'd like to comment on that we haven't covered?
No, I don't think so.
You'll leave that for the book that you write?
No, I won't be writing a book either. Somebody else is going to have to do that.
Yeah, well, except, you can't put this under wraps if there's something you'd like to not go to your grave with.
Well, I think I was just really disappointed in the manner in which the federal government under Strahl initially, but under Ritz in particular, the way they handled this whole situation, refusing to meet with the board members to discuss what they wanted to do and why they wanted to do it, having an opportunity to have some input into that discussion. And I think I felt, and at the end, when our terms were up at the board, there wasn't a letter from anybody saying thank you for your services and whatever. I just thought that pretty petty and ungraceful as far as I was concerned, but that's just a personal view. I remember the same thing happened when I was on the Ardi board.
Ardi?
The Agriculture Research and Development Initiative. And there was a change in government, and of course they changed the appointments there. And I would have thought that the least they could have done was send a thank you note. I'm sure that that's just proper business practice. And I thought it was pretty amateurish, but I think it was done out of a sort of a meanness as well. They had absolutely no use for us guys at all. Didn't treat us with any kind of respect at all.
It was a really tough time.
Yeah.
Yeah. And thank you very much for telling your story. It's unique in our record, so that's good.
I'll be very interested. Maybe I won't be all that interested, but I think my tone of voice and my speaking ability in this one will contrast significantly from the first one.
No.
You don't think so?
No. No, not as much as you would think. You're more sensitive to it, I think.
Oh, it could be.
But thank you very much.
Oh, you're welcome. I'm amazed that you've got the stamina to keep doing this.
Some people are disappointed I have the stamina to keep doing this. Anyway, it's been great because of all the wonderful people I've met.
Yeah.
And my appreciation for the whole grain industry was...
You'll still have
leaps and bounds above what I had before I started the project.
You'll still have a few more people to go on.
Not too many.
Not too many.
No, we're
getting close.
We're coming to the end, and the university, which is Lakehead University, the Research Ethics Committee that approves our ongoing project. They have decided, along with our agreement, that at the end of December we'll finish our formal interviews anyway.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, good for you. It's really a big job.
Yeah.
But you must enjoy a little bit.
Oh, just a little. Yeah. Thanks, Bill.